The Creative Business Podcast is brought to you by Noosey. Online proposals made simple for creative businesses. Visit noosey.com to learn how your business can start winning more projects today.
To the Creative Business Podcast, the podcast that aims to help you build a better, more successful creative business. I'm Nathan, and today I'm here with Marcus, as per usual. How are you doing, Marcus?
I'm doing well, Nathan.
And we're also joined by my co-founder, Michael Coper, today. How nervous are you, Michael?
Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous. This is my first time on a podcast, so I'm really excited.
We'll be gentle. We'll be gentle. So how are we doing anyway? How was your week, Marcus?
Oh, it was fabulous here. It's had snow for the first time this year, and you know, it's just beautiful.
Do you actually get out in the snow, or is it something you avoid and stay behind closed doors with a chimney?
Well, you know, I like to get out in the snow, but I'm not a big like skier or snowboarder. My kids are. I'd rather go hike around in the snow. I usually am out in the snow shoveling, which given an hour of that, I'm pretty ready to be in front of the chimney.
We've had snow here this week, actually. Although it didn't hit Madrid capital, did it, Michael?
No, it was all raining here.
All right. Okay. Well, it was snowing just up here, and there's loads of snow up in the mountains. But yeah, we didn't make it up. Apparently, there were like people trapped in their cars just up from here for like over a day. Like the emergency services couldn't get to them for over 24 hours in Spain. So you know, we're not in the middle of some hugely desolate place. Just on the A6 motorway, there were people trapped in their cars for 24 hours, which is not funny, obviously, but it's just, there was a lot of snow.
Well, you know, when it happens, sometimes it surprises, especially if you don't get snow very often. I've heard it can really kind of throw people into disarray.
Yeah, there's only three ski stations around the mountains in Madrid. So yeah, there's not really a lot of accommodation for snow around here.
But, okay.
But anyway, so what are we going to talk about this week then, Marcus?
We are talking about, for all you creative business owners who dream about having a SaaS, we are going to talk about why you should consider it, or if you should, what you should know when you kind of think about it, you know, as you move into that space of, well, is this an idea worth pursuing? The ups and downs, and of course, Nathan and Michael are SaaS experts because that's what they do full time with their lives. Is they run a SaaS, a wonderful SaaS called Noosey. And so I thought it'd be really fun. We all thought it'd be really fun to sort of have a show where we talk about, you know, what it's like going from, people who do services, because that's what both of you did, right? You did, Nathan, of course, you were design services and UX, and Michael, you did, you know, contract software development or different kinds of development services. And then you guys decided to move into what everyone seems to want these days, is the SaaS that makes money while you sleep. Does that sound about right?
That sounds like the dream. Yeah. That sounds like what people are getting sold on. Let's talk some more about that.
I know when I had a services company, you know, when I had my little agency, we talked a lot about having a SaaS. We would just dream about this idea that for $10, $20, $40 a month, we'd have some platform and we'd get thousands of people who would join. And this was our dream, was we'd never have one of these giant clients that could push us around, because nobody likes to be pushed around. And we thought, well, you know, everything on that, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. When we peeked over the fence, that grass looked so green and our grass looked so brown, or just like a patch of dirt. Why did you guys decide to start a SaaS?
Well, initially it was just me. And so for me, it was about moving. I didn't mind moving on, but moving in a different direction. As I mentioned in last week's episode, when I was freelancing, I used to write a lot about my experiences as a freelancer. And I was one of those continually worried freelancers. I was always worried about the future of what was freelance designing for me, whether there was even a future in it. Would web design development advance to such a stage that I would become obsolete? And these were big concerns of mine. So I was always looking for a product, so to speak, that I could move into. To be honest, I was desperate to have a product. I think as many people are, you know, whether you're a designer or a developer. And I was at the, I just wanted something outside of what I was doing, which at the time was freelancing and a couple of books and things. Like I said, I was kind of desperate. And in that desperation, I was looking towards things that I hated doing myself. One of the things I hated doing more than anything was writing proposals.
Wow.
Because it took me forever. I used InDesign back then as well because it gave me complete control over everything. But it was, you know, just a really long, drawn-out process. And after doing a bit of investigation and speaking to, you know, I it's once we started with this question, you kind of go down the rabbit hole, you know, because I there are so many ways to approach looking for a problem to solve. Sometimes we look in the wrong places. I mean, the way I went around it was, I gathered up a list of agencies and people in the industry that I knew of and reached out to them and sort of set up calls or met up with them in the case that they were local and asked, you know, if it was a problem that was big enough for them, whether they would look to, you know, whether an online solution would work for them. And funny enough, everyone said that they were unhappy with the solution they were using, regardless whether that was on, an online or a standalone app. But none of them said that they would swap over at this stage because they had too much invested in what they were using. So I said, sod it, and went ahead anyway. So that was how it started off for me. How it started off for Michael was completely different.
Yeah, like I met Nathan when I was working at a startup full-time here in Madrid. And Nathan was consulting for that startup. And if I remember correctly, he lent me a book. It's called Start Small, Stay Small. Am I correct? Rob Walling. Yeah, immediately after that, reading that book, I was like, I wanted to have my SaaS. And Nusi already existed, but it was like more or less like an MVP. And Nathan needed a programmer to fix a couple of bugs. But as soon as I helped him out for a couple of hours, I realized that fixing the bugs was like a little bit difficult because when I touched something at one place, it got broken in the other place. It was really like not.
It was awful.
Yeah, like let's be honest, it was not great. And then, long story short, I asked Nathan. Okay, this takes me a lot more than a couple of hours. I can work for free if you want. And the collaboration started from there, really.
I can work for free if you want, if you give me half of your business. Let's not forget that bit.
Exactly.
I was going to say, I wish I'd met you, you know, back then when you were in the mood to work for free. But so Michael, you were willing to put in your own time in trade for equity to take a chance that Nusi was going to become something worth having.
Yeah, exactly. If I remember correctly, we gave us as a team like a half year. We added we created a contract and we're gonna try it out half year, and if both of the parties are happy after that, we just continue. And I think I completely rewrote everything, and I think we launched after 5 months or so.
Yeah, because we redesigned from the ground up, didn't we? After the MVP, we redesigned and rewrote everything, and then relaunched end of September 2014, I think it was. Yeah, and that was when it sort of officially became the Nusi that everyone sort of knows now, at least in this initial version.
Knows and loves.
Well, knows and loves.
Yeah, and I think we had, with MVP, we had more or less 10 customers. Am I right?
Yeah. And it's unbelievable, actually. That MVP, like, imagine the worst piece of software you've ever seen and uninstalled from your computer. It was along those lines, if not worse. And we actually got paying customers on that. So it was unbelievable to me. That somebody would want to use that, but I guess that was just probably the validation that was needed, you know, to decide whether it was worth moving forward with.
So Nathan, let's go back for a second. Let's rewind. You said you wanted a SaaS. You wanted to move your company in a different direction. Here you've given Michael a book which has infected him with the SaaS bug as well. And you said you started thinking about the idea as, well, what do I hate to do? And that was proposals. You hated doing proposals. So if somebody's, so that's a very interesting way. I think that's not a bad way at all to imagine, you know, what would someone want, what pain would someone want to relieve? If there are people in the audience who have a pet idea, and like we, I think everyone I've met in the last 5 years has a pet idea for a SaaS. How do they know? How can they know if it's a good idea? And I'd love to hear from you too, Michael.
Well, I think the hardest thing about this pet idea you have, especially if, you know, if you've been gathering ideas for ages and there's one you hone in on particularly for whatever reason that is, it's always really hard to detach yourself from that idea outside of it being a good, better or worse idea than it is in your own head. For example, I mean, I did go and I looked at what was around. I did speak to existing agencies and companies. And even though, you know, as I mentioned, they all said it was a great idea and they liked the idea of the way it would work, they all said that they wouldn't switch at this point in time. So why did I go ahead with it? I think part of it was through pigheadedness and part of it was through this seemed like a good idea to me. And part of it was just like, I actually put aside a budget. This, I think, for me is at least a great idea for me. Because, you know, this was all bootstrapped, completely self-funded. As I was so desperate to have something out there, I said, look, I'm going to put a limit, a fiscal budget on what this MVP is going to cost me. If it doesn't work out after this, then that's it. The idea is gone, it's dead and buried. If it does, then I'll continue. So I think for me at least, and there are so many schools and ways of thinking of how validating an idea and whether to move forward. The big two things for me, three things for me really were, it was a problem that I had as a freelancer. So I had no real doubts that it was a problem for other people as well. I spoke to other people in the industry, in the same industry as myself, to see if it was a problem for them. It was. Were they willing to change? That was a different story. And the third thing as well, was that I'd set aside a budget. So I knew that no matter how badly it went, I knew that I was only going to lose X amount of dollars. And then if that hadn't panned out, then I could have moved on to the next idea. That might be a potentially expensive way of running through ideas, but it worked for me. I think the biggest danger when you're picking ideas out of the air is just going with something just because you think it's a good idea and not doing any further sounding, you know, testing outside of that. But I think, I mean, I can't really advise on that because I probably wasn't the most scientific about it, but that's the way it went. And that was the way it sort of, it worked out okay for me in the end.
Okay. Now, Michael, in this same vein here, you were working at a startup, you said. As I recall, you didn't own the startup. It was a startup that must have had some money or success because you were working there and there were other people there. What made you feel like this proposal SaaS was something worth taking a risk on?
I was really happy working at the startup, but just the idea that is like a recurring revenue, that was really appealing for me. And for me as well, like I was working in a team and I wanted to work alone, and that as a for a programmer that can be very appealing, that you can create your own thing. And yeah, and I started off with just working in weekends and nights. Back then, I didn't have a daughter yet, so I had actually time to do stuff. And that ended up in me working part-time in that startup. And in the end, I think when we hit like a revenue goal of, I don't know, like $1,000 monthly revenue or something, $1,000, I just decided, okay, we're going to go all in Nusi. And I'm really happy with that. And now I can see the benefits as having a daughter is kind of like deciding when and where you work is like really convenient. I don't understand how other parents do it without.
Actually, now I hear you say that out loud, that you decided to go all in when we hit $1,000. That probably sounds like absolute madness to somebody listening. I quit my day job when we hit 1,000 MRR between two people.
So for you, Michael, it wasn't that you had this intense pain that proposals were so painful or so difficult, or you hated writing them. For you, you wanted something else out of life. You wanted to try, I don't know whether it was take a chance, but as you said, You wanted to build something. You wanted to have more control of your life. So if Nusi had been a very different kind of SaaS, if it had been a SaaS that did something entirely different for a different market, would that have changed your opinion?
Yeah, maybe. I do love working on products that are actually useful. So like I just imagined like this beautiful app, and that's also a very big reason I wanted to work with Nathan, because of his design skills that he did in the startup. And I, yeah, like it was really appealing for me, but I've never been able to work on products that I don't care about. I do care about the proposal software. I just never wrote a proposal myself. Yeah, like it's something I really like, the problem, writing proposals. Yeah,
I think we were talking. Was it yesterday, the day before, about a company? Actually, I can remember what the company was now, so I won't name them because it sounds a bit nasty. But the solutions to the most boring problems are often the ones that are the most sought after or willing to be paid for. You know, there's just consistently dreary problems, and for me, proposals was one of those. If you are looking for a problem to find a solution to, then I recommend one of those really completely boring, dreary ones.
Yeah, that's certainly when my partners and I sat down to think about what kind of SaaS we might want, the list was oftentimes things that we felt were the big exciting problems, the things that would transform your business, that would have a huge impact. And I don't know that we had the mindset of pick the dreary, dull problems and solve those, because those probably will be around forever. Of course, this is also probably why our SaaS didn't go anywhere. Frankly, the three partners could never agree on what to build, so nothing ever got built. But since you guys are partners, that means you have to agree on a lot of things, right? How do you make decisions as partners? Or do you have silos where you don't really talk about lots of decisions because you each have areas of responsibility?
You want to go first, Michael? And then I'll disagree with everything you say.
Yeah, it is a challenge, because of course you cannot make it everything like I cannot make it everything like I want it to be. I have to agree with Nathan, and sometimes we don't agree, and then most of the times like the one that's more excited about it wins, I think. And of course anything that's design, it's mostly Nathan that wins. And obviously, if there's a program issue, like I have the last say in it. But yeah, mostly it's just about direction. Having a partner, it takes longer to decide what to build next. It's great to have somebody to discuss with. Yeah, what do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably be easy for us to just say, well, no, you're the developer, so you do everything on the development side and I do everything on the design side. And obviously that's true. I mean, you don't design and I don't develop, but I don't think the responsibilities are split. Anything that we want to do is discussed and the other has equal sort of say in whether they think that's a good or bad idea. So even if I put forward maybe a UX improvement or something, and this has happened on several occasions, if I think that something's going to be an improvement on the UX and I'll initially run it by Michael, and he might actually come back and say, well, if you do that, then this is going to create this, that, or the other situation. And then I'll say, oh, well, actually, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So it is very much both make those decisions regardless. I mean, we do have our lists of sort of, if you want to call it roadmap, features, these kinds of things, and each one is discussed. But at the same time, we will look at how important they are to moving the business forward. Sometimes there are features that you can just add just for the sake of, you know, a customer requesting them, which isn't usually a great indicator. So sometimes we just try sit down with our list and say, well, which is going to move the business forward quicker than any others? So then we prioritize what we need to look at, and then we discuss those again. But it depends on what kind of decision we're looking at making, you know. So it can vary. Sometimes Michael gets his way, sometimes I get mine. It just depends.
So you basically go back and forth and find agreement. Sounds like generally, though, you're both happy to have a partner, happy to have the other person as your partner in this endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Nusi wouldn't exist if I hadn't found Michael, or if Michael hadn't found me. Because at the beginning, you know, it was me with the MVP. I was a designer only designer. So I'd contracted the work out for the MVP. And once it got to the end of the MVP, once that was done, that was ready to go, then I was kind of out of cash, you know. The only money that was coming in via my consulting. So it was, well, what do I do now? Do I either just knock it on the head or find a technical partner? And I know this is a big pain as well for a lot of people who want to start their own SaaSes or their own products is, you know, I'm not technical. And the sort of worries and concerns about finding a technical partner. The excitement of getting Michael on board was huge. And that got us through a good while. But then that first year, I think, was more difficult for us. In fact, we were only sort of discussing this a couple of days ago, because while we'd worked together, we didn't really know each other. So that first year, I think, was difficult in that, you know, we both expected different things. You know, developers and designers and chalk and cheese, aren't they? So I could throw out designs all day long, but of course Michael can't turn those designs around into concepts or feature releases in the same amount of time. So expectations and from both sides can be very different. So finding that partner can be tricky. Luckily for Michael and I, it worked out. That first year, I think, was a year of getting to know each other, and it did have its ups and downs. But I think once we got to know each other, that things kind of settled down. My expectations of what could be done in a certain amount of time changed as well. And I don't know for Michael, he can tell you now, but I know that I've certainly changed since we first launched in 2014.
Michael, how has he changed? Yeah.
In the beginning, the struggle was that there were so many features that we had to add. So we didn't really know which one to start. So we just picked one, and then there were like requests of other features. So in the end, if it's just one developer, it's not going very fast. And I think Nate in the beginning really had the idea that everything is going to be easier, but developing takes always time, and now the expectations are a bit better, I think. We go a decent speed right now, but it's just like focusing on one feature that really helped as well. Yeah, in the beginning, it was a big struggle.
So let's kind of, as you guys are thinking back, I think it's a great question that I heard somebody ask once, like, what is something... And I think you've already told us, but what's one thing each of you, that was a lot harder than you expected when you started, as you were imagining what it was going to be like?
I think the hardest part was getting the users to stay, because they were like churning very easy because Nusi wasn't really mature yet. I think if you have, let's say, 50 customers and 5 are canceling, that is such a... takes so much effort to get those users to sign up in the first place, and then they just leave. And if you have a little bit more customers, that means every month more leave. And that was, I think, one of the most difficult things for me, at least.
Michael, when you say it was difficult, was it difficult financially or emotionally? Why was it difficult to watch people leave?
For me, I think it was more emotionally. Like, you see in the logs that people sign up and they don't really use the app, and you don't know why, and that is really frustrating. And you hear so many success stories that is like in a couple of months they were already at $10,000 monthly revenue. It's so difficult to have like a really to solving really like a pain that people are actually paying money for it. Yeah, it was just a more personal level of frustration, I think.
Okay. Nathan, over to you. What was something that was harder than you expected it to be?
The need for continual marketing. I think both of us coming from the backgrounds that we had, neither of us were marketers. And at least I didn't realize just how much we would need to be on that all the time. You know, in the past, before I was a business owner, so to speak, you know, I didn't, it's not something I really had to worry about. So marketing and getting the right number of people, or rather trying to increase the number of people who were reaching us on a monthly basis, was not something that I'd ever it's not something I realized would be quite so difficult. And it's still, I think, probably the most hard, you know, the most difficult thing, the biggest area of concern we have is marketing. You know, it's especially when you're a bootstrap product, because you don't have necessarily have those funds to invest in maybe an outside marketer or a huge ad spend or, you know, whatever it might be. I think it's, for me, that's been the most difficult thing, without a doubt.
And I think for me, the most difficult part of marketing is like, you read so many blog posts like of tactics that work for other people, but then you try the same tactics and then it doesn't work for you because you have a complete different product and audience. With program, it's a lot easier. Like if you have a problem somewhere, you just read a blog post and you can implement that, and then it's so easy. But with marketing, that is just so difficult.
Yeah, completely. And I think part of that as well is the fact that, you know, we're both pretty introverted, and I think in marketing and, you know, and being an introvert don't necessarily get on well too well. So that doesn't help matters either. So that's something we need to work past.
So let's flip the question around. When you started this out, I'm sure both of you had a conception of what was going to be hard, but maybe didn't turn out to be hard. So I'm curious, what, Nathan, we'll start with you this time. What's something that was actually easier than you expected, or something that you thought was going to be a problem that never materialized?
I think something, this wasn't something I considered before, because I think when you're building a bootstrap product, SaaS in this case, my expectations really, really didn't go further than actually getting it launched and having a website. One of the things that was a surprise, perhaps, let's put it that way, to me, was how easily we've been able to make a name for ourselves. And I mean that in the sense of, most often when you see one of these articles on, you know, how to write proposals for your agency or your business or any of these sort of lists or recommendations, we're always up there against the big players. And that still surprises me, because, you know, we are a team of two. They, you know, companies don't really get any smaller than that. That surprised me. And I, maybe easy, I don't think is the right way, the right term, but yeah, that was that surprised me.
Okay. And how about you, Michael? Something where you were anticipating it was going to be difficult, but turned out to not be hard, or maybe wasn't even a problem at all?
Customer service. I would expect that I would be terrible at that, but that is actually like just the easiest part is customer service.
Michael's really good at customer service.
It's just because I'm not good at talking to people, but I'm good at writing people, and that has been very easy. And in the end, you're just helping them, and that gives a really good feeling. And I expected I would hate customer service in the beginning, but that's actually some of the nicest things to do in a company, I think.
Nice. I could see that, dreading that, and then finding that because you were able to really help people, it's not a frustrating experience. I'm sure people are kind to you when you can help them. Generally, they're probably very, very friendly.
Yeah, exactly. They just are really, they're so thankful that you just solve their problems. It's been really nice.
So somebody has asked, and I don't know where we got this question, but I really like it. So I'll just throw it out to both of you, because I think it reflects a certain mindset. How long will it take to get my first 100 customers? How many days or weeks will that take, Nathan?
How long is a piece of string?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. If you look at the success stories, they've already got their first 100 customers before they've even launched. But actually, looking back, I mean, I can't remember how long it took us to get our first 100 customers. I don't think it was actually that long, to be honest, because like I said, when we went from MVP to the initial launch, on the MVP, we already had 10 customers, I think, and 10 paying customers. It didn't take long. I just think it depends. There are two things here, obviously. One is, Is it a sticky app? You know, is it something that people actually need to use? And have you been able to, you know, market it in a way that ensures that enough people are going to actually see your product or service? So I think if you've got those two things in place, then I don't think it's going to take you very long. But again, I mean, this is just dependent on so many things.
So one thing you mentioned was, and I've heard this as a recurring theme, this idea that you're reading a lot of other success stories about how other startups and SaaS apps are doing. I think you mentioned in your answer that a lot of times when you read a successful, you know, when we, if we ask, how long does it take to get my first 100 customers? By the time you read somebody's report or you hear about somebody and how successful they are, they've already got their first 100 customers, even before they open the doors for anybody to pay. And I wonder, does all this success talk about, it's almost like how well all these other SaaSes are doing. Was that an encouragement to you as SaaS owners, or did it ever become frustrating to just hear how great everything was going for what appeared like every other SaaS on the internet?
Yeah, I think definitely when you're first building something, you're reading all these success stories or listening to interviews with successful founders, and it does get you fired up. And I think in that way, it can be helpful because it gets you excited about the possibilities. But of course, at the back of your mind, I guess you've always got that, oh, that could be us, that could be us. Whereas, you know, 99 out of 100 ideas or 99 out of 100 startups are going to fail. I mean, actually, I think there's a huge statistic, isn't there? Like, was it like 70% of startups in the US close within the first year or something? After a while, I think you start realizing that, yeah, it's not necessarily going to be that way for you. I don't even read blogs anymore. And in fact, there's been a huge boom, obviously, in SaaS. I think we're at the very edge of what is probably a bubble about to burst. But I mean, the proposal platforms have exploded as well over the last year. Some of them you see are going on to be really successful. Sometimes you see them and you say, oh no, not another one. You know, are they going to be as successful? Are they going to take all our customers? But in the end, you just have to stop and just, you can't really give it any sort of credence or any, because otherwise you would get so down, I think, on, you know, when you compare yourselves to something great. And you're obviously not as great as them. You never will be, regardless of how much money you're making or how many customers you have. It can just become like a self-defeating sort of thing. So
yeah, in the beginning, yeah, you read a lot of success stories and you think like, yeah, I can do this, which is a good motivation to create a product. But in the end, it's been less pleasant to read all the success stories, because the thing is just, everybody only talks about their success, but they don't say the effort it took them. All the problems, they just forget to put it in a blog post.
Yeah, I think you have to define what success looks like for you before you really get into the business side of it. So, like Michael said, we're still freelancers essentially. I mean, we're a company, but we're two freelancers, and we both work full time on Nusi, and we both live full-time off Nusi, you know, with our families and our mortgages or rents or whatever. So, of course, we still want to grow more and more, obviously. But, you know, it's already a success. You know, it's not, no investor can turn around tomorrow and say, you know what, you're not growing quickly enough, we're closing the doors. That's not something that can ever happen for us. So I think you just have to define what success looks like for you, and then you can take those success stories that you read about constantly with a pinch of salt or not.
I love it. And now that you've joined the ranks of the successful ones, as you said, you get to define what success looks like. And it seems like both of you consider it to be a success. What do you attribute this success too?
I think the customer thing was a big part of it, because we've always played off the fact that we are small, and that we've always been honest that, you know, anybody who contacts us through Nusi contact customer service is only ever going to speak to Michael or myself. Like, they're not going to be put to some help desk or outsourced or anything. So we're always in direct contact with our customers. And I think especially that was a big help in the beginning, because we were able to literally jump on a call or have direct emails with customers. And a lot of people really valued that. That's still carried through to today as well. I mean, we actually had a Christmas card come through this Christmas through one of our customers, you know, which I think is probably pretty rare for a SaaS. So I think the customer service was a big part, I think, of our success, because sure, there are other bigger players out there who've got, you know, loads more money and huge teams and everything. But I think that's part of the charm, I think, or the appeal of that, you know, we can take care of you and we will take care of you. And I think the other appeal is that Nusi was designed by a designer who had a problem. Like, it wasn't designed by a company who was looking for a problem to solve, i.e. they're outsourcing to a team to create a solution. So because my whole background was design and UX, a lot of the feedback we've had since the beginning is that customers love the way it works. they love the UX and the flow and the fact that it's easy to use. And I know every app makes that claim, you know, it's the easiest to use, the most simple, blah, blah, blah. People are always going to find one app that works better for them than another one. We just be lucky enough to find people that appreciate the simplicity of Nusi. You know, we've never claimed to be an all-in-one solution. We try and take a big problem, distill it down to the easiest possible use. You know, like I said, I hate writing proposals and I want to spend as little time as possible writing proposals. So yeah, I think that was part of the appeal.
Getting a Christmas card from one of your customers sounds pretty awesome. How did you build that kind of customer loyalty, that feeling that people like, sounds like they actually cared about the two of you, not just the name and the company?
I feel kind of cheesy when you say these kind of things, but I think it was just caring, you know. Like Michael said, it makes you feel good when you can help somebody and they're genuinely happy with the sort of the help that they've received. Michael works in an office in the center of Madrid, and I work in my home office in the outskirts of Madrid, and we're in Slack all day together. And every time we have one of these moments, and you know, a customer says something really nice, you know, we're just, it makes your day, you know, and we comment about it. And I think it's just that, just being close. And I think as well, there are customers who get what we are. They get that, you know, we're not behind a corporate wall, that they are talking to two people. Some people don't get it immediately because they might come to the website and think, oh, it's just another funded startup that coming out of the valley who've got a big team and funding behind them. But once they realize that it is, you know, a real person behind there, I think that's, it makes a difference. And, you know, people appreciate talking to people who actually know their first name in most cases, and you know, and they can call us by our first name. You know, it's not the operator or whatever, the customer support.
Yeah, I think what Nathan said, and I think this this user that sent Christmas card. I remember that he asked for a feature, and the same day that feature was live. So yeah, because we are so small, we are really fast. Sometimes with feature requests. If we both really like it, then I just try my best to edit as quickly as possible. And just within a week, it's live, or within a day sometimes. And people really, really love that you actually listen. In the end, that is really, really easy. Just listen to their problems and then try to make a solution. Having said that, you shouldn't listen to all the customer's problem, because then your app is going to be a mess. But these key problems, that has been very nice to quickly make them possible.
I am curious, how do you, what's your litmus test for knowing which feedback, what comments, what features from customers to act on and which ones to set aside?
Yeah, a lot of feedback or requests we get, it's already in the pipeline. So when somebody asks it, we just move it a little bit forward. But sometimes, yeah, we have to, we just call each other and then we decide yes or no, and then we edit or not.
Yeah, to be like Michael says, to be fair, most of the feature requests we get, we do already have in a roadmap. But I think, yeah, and like you said as well, it just depends how often we hear that same feature request. So we look at the number of customers it's actually going to affect. For example, I mean, if we get a request for something that, you know, since 2014 is the first time it's ever been requested, chances are that, you know, it's not going to be a deal breaker for a new customer. It might be for them, and we might have to say, no, I'm sorry, but that's not something we're going to implement. And that does happen as well. You just have to be prepared to be able to say no as well. But yeah, it just depends how many people is going to help out of the entire client base, and how does it fit into the roadmap as well. So I think it's rare that we do get requests that we haven't even sort of thought about in the past. But I mean, it does happen. But we just chalk it up against how many people will it affect in a positive way. And if it does, then great. As Michael said, it gets moved up the list. And if it doesn't, then we just say, I'm sorry, it's not something we're looking at.
Well, let's turn our eyes forward to 2018 and 2019 and, boy, 2020. What is the future of your company, of your startup? How, you know, what plans do you have? How do you hope to grow? What's on the roadmap?
We're going to take over the world.
Going to take over the world. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Can you be any more specific for us?
I think if I can answer this one, I think we talked about it a couple of months ago. I think we both want to add a couple of people to the company, but we don't want to become managers. We want to stay small. And it sounds very cliche, but we really don't want to become managing. We really don't want to manage other people.
I think, yeah, we don't want to become a CEO or CTO. And I think it's like, we definitely still want to continue to grow. Obviously, if we don't grow, then, you know, at some point it will end up just disappearing. I spoke about this as well a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, the whole work-life balance. We both have really great lives in the fact that we have families, we work from, you know, from wherever we choose and sort of how and when. We have almost complete freedom, and that's something we want to maintain. So, you know, to some of those bigger funded SaaSes and startups out there who are working, you know, the hours that they're working, that's not something that interests us. And we've been approached as well by firms offering money, offering to talk about funding and things like that. And we just said no to all of them because we want to be able to grow, but we want to be able to grow organically in a rate that we can handle. So yes, hopefully in the future, that would mean being able to take on someone possibly part-time with customer support, and also being able to take on possibly a developer either on a project basis or on a free time basis, sort of part-time basis. Like Michael said, we've no desires to become managers. We still want to be able to enjoy the time we have. That just means that Nusi will grow at the rate that we can naturally grow it at. But with regards to the actual app itself, don't know. I'm not really sure how. I mean, sure, we have our roadmap. We've got the next 12 months sorted, but after that, it's anyone's guess. I mean, I was listening to an interview the other day with Josh Pigford, and he was saying that, you know, over the last few years, we've had this explosion of SaaS apps that only take care of one tiny, very focused problem. And in the case of Nusi, it was proposals. Now Nusi takes on proposals and reporting and probably contracts as well in the future as well. He was saying that people tend to be moving more towards the old-fashioned, as we say, in inverted commas, all-in-one solutions who are solving more than one problem. And while I have no idea where Nusi will end up in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years' time, you know, maybe it will end up becoming part of a bigger solution. I don't know. It's not something we've discussed.
That's exciting. And I suppose that's half the appeal of this lifestyle of owning a SaaS is it's a continual ride. The industry changes, people's tastes change, and you get to decide how you want to adapt to those things. Nathan and Michael, thank you so much for, you know, it's been great on the Creative Business Podcast today to hear about the struggles, the pain, the joy, the unexpected even joy of customer service of running a SaaS app. And I've really enjoyed it. I just want to thank both of you for, you know, just sharing your heart, sharing your experiences with those of us who look over the fence and imagine that grass is always greener. It sounds like a pretty good life, but it also sounds like it's not for the faint of heart. And if you're listening, you probably should not just enter into this without really thinking about what success means to you. And with that, we'll close out the Creative Business Podcast today. Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you both.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. We'll be back next week, next Tuesday. And if you've enjoyed today's show and any of our past episodes, then, you know, you'd be doing a huge favor if you drop by iTunes and leave us a review. And if you have any suggestions again, that domain we mentioned last week, Marcus, thecreativebusinesspodcast.com, nobody bought it. So if you have any suggestions about things you'd like to hear discussed on the show, or ideas or feedback or whatever, you know, just drop us a line, podcast@thecreativebusinesspodcast.com, and we'll get back to you. All right, guys, have a great weekend.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Thank you.